Let's start out in Luke 10, and this will be a weird context for a men's day. Normally, when I study or I preach, my thought process is just simple. You read the text, and you identify your facts. Who, what, when, where, how much, how high, how big, how many. Who was writing, who was he writing to, and what was going on when he wrote it. You understand all your facts. You define all your words. When you get the facts, then you build concepts. And from the concepts, you build applications. So you'll notice that a lot of times when I preach, I'll get into one context and stay there. Again, I think that's how the Bible was written. You know, you understand what Paul said to the Romans before you start worrying about what he said to the Ephesians, that affects what he said to the Romans. Because the Romans only got the Roman letter. They didn't have the ability to go to the letter of the Ephesians. We have the ability to see what was written to all the churches. But if you really, really want to understand, you've got to understand it in its context first. So facts, concepts, applications. We're going to start in Luke 10, having said that, and then move into Ephesians 4. But I want to just look at this, and maybe from a men's day perspective, it's a weird context. Luke 10, 38. Now it happened, as they went and entered a certain village, and a certain woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. She had a sister called Mary, who also sat at Jesus' feet and heard his word. Mary and Martha live in Bethany. Bethany is on the backside, what I call the backside of the Mount of Olives. And so when Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane, it's probably less than a mile to walk from the Garden of Gethsemane to Mary, Martha, and Lazarus' house. And so he's at this house, and he's a guest, and he's there to teach. Because Mary is sitting at his feet, listening to his word. Verse 40, but Martha was distracted with much serving. And she approached him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me alone to serve? Therefore, tell her to help me. And Jesus answered and said, Martha, Martha, you are worried and troubled about many things, but one thing is needed, and Martha has chosen that good part, which will not be taken away from her. So you've got the visiting preacher at your house. What has to happen when the visiting preacher's at your house? It's in the book of Second Opinions. Got to feed him. So the preacher, the visiting rabbi, the visiting preacher comes to their house, and somebody got to feed this guy. So Martha is worried and distracted with much serving. Who is she serving in her mind? She's serving the Lord, right? Have you ever tried to serve the Lord and it made you mad? Okay, in Huntsville, this means yes. And this means no. This means you're not voting. Yeah. You ever tried to serve the Lord and been frustrated? Not only is she frustrated, she's frustrated at the Lord and her sister. She's mad at Mary and throws Jesus on the bus too. Lord, don't you care? She's left me alone. How many times have you been involved in something that was frustrating in the name of church work? Right? Now, I believe in evangelism. My very first door-knocking campaign as a youth minister, I was attacked by a Doberman. A good-sized Doberman looked me right in the eye. I beat it with a King James Bible. And didn't convert it, didn't come to church a single time, but I wore it out. We choose to door-knock in July in Alabama. It was 111 degrees in the shade, 98% humidity. I know what I looked like. When I had hair, I looked worse. They look at that little hole. They don't see anybody. Down here, you know. I know what I sound like, too. I had a kid ask me one time. I was over in Cookeville, Tennessee, and I was eating lunch with Buddy Johnson. Sitting there at a big fellowship dinner. And his son, Luke, was 10 at the time. He come over there and sat down and said, Mr. Lonnie, can I ask you a question? Buddy just, that chest just, my son about to ask the visiting preacher a question. I said, yes, sir, young man. What? Hey, are you the voice of Daffy Duck? I get it, okay? I know what I look like standing on your porch wanting to have a Bible study with you, and it frustrates me. Martha was distracted with much serving, and it frustrated her. Now, I'm assuming that my experience in church is similar to yours, that we've all been involved in something that, number one, we felt like we're the only person doing it. Everybody else was doing something else, and it wasn't very effective. And we got mad at our brethren and got a little sideways with the Lord, just to tell you the truth, right? The youth ministers in the room, let's go to Six Flags, let's go to the water park, and you've got to rent 2 12-raised buses. Let's go do something that involves some hard work and some labor and what? You know, the 4 kids who are not popular show up, right? I want to talk to us about the fingerprint of discipleship in the form of service, as service relates to evangelism, and see if I can get a different perspective. Not buying anything, not selling anything. I want to make some observations. Ephesians chapter 4. When Paul writes to the Christians at Ephesus, he outlines chapter 1 with God has a plan, God has a purpose. Look at the intentional language in Ephesians 1. He predestined, he chose according to his good pleasure, according to the purpose of his will. God's going to do something with people. And gave him to be head over all things to the church, which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all. Paul says, look, the fulfillment of God's intentions is in this thing we call the church. Now, as he explains the body, the church, as the fulfillment of God's plan from the foundation of the world, before God said, let there be light, he had a plan for us. He said, this mystery that I've been put in charge of is really to do two things. It's going to bring together God and people, and it's going to bring together people and people. We're going to eliminate the distinction between Jew and Gentile. In fact, Paul's going to go ahead and say, we're going to eliminate all those distinctions. There's neither slave nor free. There's neither circumcised, uncircumcised, neither barbarian. There's neither Scythian. There's neither Jew nor Greek. The New Testament church was not a church bogged down in demographics. Now, I do believe there's some special need groups. I do believe there's some things that we need to do differently for each group in order to be more effective in our teaching. But the bottom line is, we've become a church of separate identities. Nobody in the New Testament church ever got up and said, there'll be a meeting of the Scythian ministry today in the fellowship hall. All non-Scythians are welcome to it. Neither barbarian, nor Scythian, nor slave, nor free, nor Jew, nor Gentile. It wasn't what does the church do for the singles. It wasn't what does the church do for the young marriage. It's what do the young marriage do for the church. What do the singles do for the church. And we've created this compartmentalization. Well, Paul says it's a body. Never describes the New Testament church as an organization. It's only ever described as an organism. And he says the body is designed to bring God and people together and people and people together. No more Jews, no more Gentiles. We're going to unite God and people and people and people. And then after he explains the purpose of the mystery, he'll start, in chapter 4. And if you use the King James, the New King James, he'll use the word walk. If you use any other translation, he'll use the word live. But he'll talk about walk in unity, walk different than the Gentiles, walk in love, walk circumspectly, walk wise. And he'll use walk, 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 or live, live. So he's going to give us 4 or 5 different ways that as members of the body we're supposed to walk or we're supposed to live. And it's in the middle of walking worthy of our calling, living consistently with what we've been called, that I want us to look at. So Ephesians chapter 4, verse 7. But to each one of us grace was given according to the measure of Christ's gift. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, he led captivity captive and gave gifts to men. Now, he's going to do a parenthetical statement in verse 9 and 10 to talk about, you know, if he ascended, that means that he had to descend first before you can ascend. Don't get lost in that. Okay? Because really, the thought continues like this. Therefore, he says, when he ascended on high, He led captivity captive and gave gifts to men, and He Himself gave some to be apostles and some to be prophets and some to be evangelists and some to be pastors and some to be teachers. So His intention here is, why did Christ give these gifts? Now this imagery He uses, He led captivity captive, is a Roman army imagery. That when a Roman general came back into town after conquering some place, he had a ticker tape parade. And he rides in on his chariot or with his group of guys, and behind him are the slaves that he's captured and the jewels and the gold and the horses and the camels. As he rides down Main Street, he's passing out gifts. He's giving gifts to men. So he's got this imagery of Christ as a conquering general. The only other time he uses that is in 2 Corinthians 3. 2 Corinthians 2, thanks be to God who leads us in triumphal victory. In that context, Paul sees himself as one of the slaves. I've been conquered, and I'm a slave of Christ. I'm being led through town. So he uses this imagery twice, and it's different the both times he uses it. But does he? Jesus has conquered, and He ascended on high. He led captivity captive, and now He's giving gifts to men. And probably in this context, it's miraculous gifts. Some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be pastors, some to be teachers. But why did He give those gifts? The principle of why those gifts were given is what I want us to think about when we think about the discipleship fingerprint of love. And if love is service, let's talk about service. Gave some to be apostles and some to be prophets and some to be evangelists, some to be pastors and some to be teachers for the equipping of the saints, for the work of ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. Let's make sure we're on the same page. He's given these gifts out, these abilities to do, to pastor or to teach or to be prophetic or to be evangelist. Why? So that the saints could be equipped to do ministry. Now, who are the saints? Not dead people and not a football team in New Orleans. It's us. He's given abilities, gifts to people so that we would be equipped, so we would have equipment. You ever tried to do a job without the right equipment? And how much better it is when you have the proper equipment to do a job? I've got a minor in art. I was going to have a double major in Bible and in art. And I was a very poor person in college. And I took a semester of art, drawing and media. And the next semester of my freshman year, it was painting. And I got the list of stuff you had to buy to paint. Canvases and brushes and oil paints. And I just couldn't afford it. Just couldn't do it. So I dropped the painting class. I continued to take drawing classes until the end of it was pencil and paper. I would turn in my drawings on computer paper that I got from the Bible building because I was the janitor in the Bible building, and I'd take the trash out, and they had these large dot matrix printers. I could draw on the back side of that. Didn't have any lines. I always made C's in art because I never turned it in on the right kind of paper. But I didn't have the equipment to be an artist. So that's what I did. Well, if you've ever tried to repair something and didn't have the right equipment, you know, you cut down a tree with a dull saw or cut down a tree without a chainsaw. God said, I've given the saints equipment to do work of ministry. Now, what does ministry mean? Ministry is not up front, out loud, wearing a tie with a title. You don't have to be a preacher, an elder, or a deacon to do ministry. Ministry is a word that means service. And you have the equipment you have, and I have the equipment I have, so that I can do things to serve people. For the edifying of the body of Christ. Now, what does edification mean? It is not the process of becoming more like Ed. Okay? Edification simply means growth. So, if you've got a skill set, and I've got a skill set, and we use it to serve other people, what will happen to the body? It will increase. It will either get stronger or bigger. That sounds like evangelism to me, doesn't it, to you? Now, at some point, we've had this idea that evangelism has to be programized. And you've got to have it. When Jesus told His disciples in Matthew 28, "Go ye into all the world," the people who are smarter than me tell me that is an aorist participle in Greek. And an aorist participle is a continuing action verb. It's not go, but as you are going about, make disciples. Evangelism is not about leaving here and going to Mexico for 3 weeks. Evangelism is not about leaving here and going to paint houses in Knoxville. Evangelism is the houses you jog by, the place you pump your gas, the place you clock in at work, and where you buy your groceries. As you are going about. And I go about in a circle because my skill set puts me in a circle. And you are in a circle because your skill set puts you in a circle. I talked to a lot of youth ministers in the course of a year, and I try to give them the concept of significant obscurity. Now, significant obscurity is an oxymoron. It's like jumbo shrimp in Kentucky football. Okay, it's things that don't go together. But significant obscurity means I'm in this little area. I'm obscure, but I'm going to be significant in it. The 8 people at my shop. 25 families in my neighborhood. The kids on my softball team. The place where my daughter goes to school. Those people are going to know that I'm a disciple because they're going to see the fingerprint of love. Because I'm going to be serving them in some way, shape, or form. Now watch what happens when this happens. He gave some to be apostles, and some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors, and some to be teachers for the equipping of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ, till we all come to the unity of faith and the knowledge of the Son of God, to a perfect man, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And by the way, this is one sentence. English teachers' heads are exploding all over the world when you read this. He starts in about verse 11, and it's one sentence all the way through. So I have my gifts that God gave me. It's my equipment to do works of ministry so the body will grow. And when the body grows because we are serving, we attain unity of faith and we attain unity of knowledge and the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. Now, what happens when you measure someone's stature? That's how high you are. That's how tall you are. Little kids at church are always like, "Mr. Lonnie, I'm taller than you." Yeah, it's like being smarter than a lizard. Anything to brag about, you're taller than me. I was doing a project for a guy. He is a house and groundskeeper for a group of doctors in Huntsville. A couple of neurosurgeons and a couple of back surgeons. And so he does everything around their house. One of the houses is in the old historical district of Huntsville. Got this massive oak tree in the yard. And people are always just randomly stepping off the curb into these people's yards and having their pictures made. Well, the lady that's married to this doctor tells my buddy Tony, "I want you to put a big swing in this oak tree so when people stop and have their picture made, they've got a swing." Well, Tony called me and said, "Lion, I don't know anything about swings." I said, "Tony, I'll take an afternoon. We'll come over there and put you a swing in." So I'm over there with some of my toys, and we put this beautiful swing, got down to the last 8 feet and braided the rope so it looks like a spiral. The guy's doctor said, "Did you make that look like a double helix molecule for DNA?" I said, "No, that's just a braided rope, son." Tied these monkey's fist knots below it so it looks like it's floating on these 4 white balls. And so we're going to build a really nice swing. Well, while I'm there, Tony says, "You need to come and look at this house. It's an old, old house. Used to have a breezeway through it. I used to call it a dog trot. And they closed it in." And so we're looking at this house, and there's a wall over here on the right, and it's got a frame around it, like you build a picture frame or a window frame. And there's a light inside there, and you look, and it's recessed. And you can see where there have been several different versions of walls in this house. Maybe some faux brick and some stucco, and all the way back to the original wood. And there's a charcoal line and these words. "In 1835, I was this tall. Say it again." and they preserved it. It's shellacked onto the wall, and some person, Sandy, a little boy or a little girl, stood against that wall and drew a line. Turned away and said, in 1835, this tall, and wrote their name. It's amazing. The measure of the stature of Sandy is this little charcoal line. Well, what would happen if we stood against the wall as a church and we marked our line? And then Jesus stood against the wall and marked His line, and our line and Jesus' line were the same line. How amazing would it be if the church looked like Christ? Church of Christ. Christians. When we do work like we're supposed to do work, we use our gifts, our talents, as equipment to serve, the body grows, and we begin to look like Christ, a fingerprint of discipleship. And, keep reading, this is one sentence, verse 14, that we should no longer be children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men and the cunning craftiness of deceitful plotting. See, when we get evangelism right, and we're doing it with the fingerprint of discipleship, because if I'm a disciple, I make disciples, and the disciples I make disciples. If we do that because we're using our skill sets to serve, because that's what God equipped us with to do. I'm not supposed to do your job. You're not supposed to do my job. I'm supposed to do mine. Then we reach the measure of the stature and fullness of Christ, and then we're no longer children. We're no longer infants. We're no longer immature, tossed to and fro and carried about by trickery and deceit. I'm a great magician if you're under the age of 10. I can amaze and astound you. But if you're not a child, I can't fool you. Yeah, that's in His other hand. Those cards are marked. Whatever you want to do with what. My preaching has been blessed. I started working as a youth minister in the spring of 1980. Was allowed to preach once a month. Was invited to camps and retreats and other places. And in the course of my preaching, I've really never had to combat a lot of false doctrine. I've just been fortunate that the places I've lived and the areas I've worked, I've been able to talk about not why we're better than them, but how we can be better. I've always been able to talk about not why we're different than them, let's be more like Christ. When I lived in Salem, Arkansas, I had a faith healer come through, camped over there by the river. Said he's going to raise me back from the dead on a Thursday. I went to see him after supper one night. Said, now, so you're going to raise this guy from the dead Thursday? He said, yes, I am. I'm going to be. I said, be prepared to do it twice. He said, I'm sorry. I said, the first time he comes out of that coffin, I'm going to put him back in it for this 357. I said, because if you can do it once, you can do it twice, right? Well, he left town under the cover of darkness. The only time I really had to dance with him. But the few times that I've had to sit down and cross swords and say, this is not gospel, or this is gospel, you know what it's been about? Some scheme, some trick for church growth. Hey, let's do one of these. Let's create one of those. Let's buy this program. Let's run these buses. Let's compromise on this doctrine. Every time I've ever had to deal with anybody that was dealing in false doctrine, it was they wanted to make some kind of get rich quick, make the church grow super fast. It was a scheme and a trick. And how many times have we been vulnerable to it? The latest program. If you want to get in shape, build muscle, lose weight, watch what you eat, do some push-ups, some pull-ups, some dips, and run a little bit. Done. You can't out-exercise a bad diet, and you can't out-diet bad exercise. And if you won't do push-ups in your living room, you won't drive across town and do CrossFit. If you won't do push-ups in your driveway, you won't get on a Peloton bike any more often than you do your push-ups. It's fundamentals. Church growth is about men serving in their community with their skill set. And when we do it like we're supposed to do it, we have unity of faith, unity of knowledge. We reach the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. We're no longer children. We become false doctrine proof. Continue reading. That we no longer be children tossed to and fro and carried around with every wind of doctrine by the trickery of men and the cunning craft and deceitful plotting, but speaking the truth in love, we grow up into all things into Him who is the head, that is Christ. And when it comes time to deal with the false teacher, or it comes time to deal with somebody who's presenting either false gospel or gospel plus one, we speak the truth in love. Now, fellas, let me tell you, I grew up in the South. I grew up in the buckle of the Bible Belt. And we've had truth. I mean, we've got it. I think our method of interpretation of Scripture is without par. But we've been missing on the love category a long time. And I believe we've been so worried about proving that we're right that we really weren't worried about whether we were right with God or not. And I'm not an expert in human behavior. I've worked with a SWAT team for 27 years. I'm trained as a negotiator. I work with critical incident training. I teach mental health awareness, patrol tactics for the emotionally disturbed at the police academy. I've been in private practice as a therapist for 21 years. In my limited experience, when I see aggression on the part of a male, the underlying component to that aggression is fear or insecurity. You show me a guy who's got to be inked up, thugged up, and chained up, walking around strut like a rooster, he wants you to think he's tough because he believes he's not fundamental. And we can't take what the Bible teaches, though it is presented by the apostles and the Messiah, and show people the truth of God in love. And we have to be harsh, cruel, debating, demeaning, and mean-spirited. It's because we are insecure in our position. And we're afraid we may not be as right as we thought we were. We have been guilty of speaking the truth without love. And you may win an argument, but you will lose a soul. A better way to do it than what has been done in the past. We're not going to be vulnerable to these false doctrines. We're not going to be children who can be tossed to and fro. But when we do speak the truth, we're going to speak the truth in love. And people who know the truth and have the truth don't have to get cranked up when they talk about the truth. There's a thing in psychology, especially working with couples, I think either John Gottman or Dr. Buhlman discovered it, called diffuse physiological arousal. And diffuse physiological arousal is when you and I get into a conversation or we get into a conflict in our marriage and our heart rate goes up and our breathing changes, we get unbalanced in our pH, we get a little shot of adrenaline. If your hands are sweaty, you're angry. If your hands are cold, you're scared. When you get diffuse physiological arousal, so when you talk with your spouse about something and you get cranked up and you don't have the ability to self-soothe, when your heart rate goes above 100 beats a minute, you move from the forebrain to the midbrain. In the midbrain, you're about as complicated as a goat. You see things in black and white. You have tunnel vision. You don't process logic or humor. There's a correlation between diffuse physiological arousal and divorce, and the correlation is 0.9. Perfect correlation is one. So if I put something in my hand and move my hand out from under, it will hit the ground every time. That's a perfect correlation. Diffused physiological arousal and dysfunctional relationships have a correlation of 0.9. So when you're studying the Bible with people and you're discussing right and wrong and you're discussing New Testament pattern and you're discussing inspiration, you're discussing authority, if you're doing it with diffused physiological arousal, you will not be an effective teacher. You speak the truth, and you speak the truth in love from the confidence and the calmness that we do have the inspired Word of God, and we know what the New Testament pattern is. when it's got to be a debate and it's got to be a fight. The devil's already won that battle. You read Ephesians 5, the end of this book, when he talks about the armor of God. And we read that armor. Oh man, we like that armor stuff. Helmets and swords and breastplates and shields and boots and hard, you know. Don't think about going to war. See, when a Roman soldier walks outside in enemy territory, he's not in his blue jeans and his flip-flops. In order for a Roman to survive in Palestine, he needs a helmet and a breastplate and a shield. He's not there hacking up everybody he runs into. It's a survival suit. My wife and I sometimes snorkel. The first place we ever snorkeled was in Alaska. Now, I don't know why she chose to snorkel in Alaska for the first time. It was because there was a poster of somebody holding a starfish that was the size of a large pizza. And my wife can overcome any of her fears to get to touch something or take a picture of something. She said, "We need to do that." I said, "Baby, they're not going to let you pick that starfish up." She said, "Hey, this picture here, can you really pick those starfish up?" We're gone. So we're going to learn to snorkel in Alaska. Alaska is cold. The water is cold. Okay? So we get to this place, we're going to go to snorkel. And by the way, you snorkel, and it's probably not as deep as this building is. But you go just a little further out on the shelf, and it drops off into blackness. I believe I can see the glow from the center of the earth. That's how deep it was. And there are things down there that are large enough for me to smack. So So they put us in these neoprene suits. And you don't just slide into one of those. You've got to fight your way into it. Nobody gets in one of those little masks. I black my own eye trying to, So I got the suit on, the little boots, the gloves, and a balaclava. I came out with the intense urge to fight crime. Then they put this mask on me, stuck a tube in my mouth. And they put me in the cold water. Now, I'm a land walker and an air breather. And here I am in cold water, and I'm insulated because the water gets in your suit. Your body temperature warms the water. It reflects off the suit, and you're snug as a bug in a rug. And I got a tube in my mouth that sticks up out of the water. I can breathe. I got this thing on my face I can see in the water and find the starfish where my wife found it. And here I am, a land walker and an air breather in the water. Paul writes about this Christian armor, not so we can go to war, but it's a survival suit. It's how a spiritual creature walks around in a physical world. Now, when I got out of the water, you can't get that thing off either. And this young lady, and I mean uncomfortably young lady, was saying that the way to get out of this suit is we'd pour hot water down your costume. Well, I didn't want her pulling that costume out very far from me and so I said, "I'll pass, I'll fight my way out of this thing." Well, she sneaks up behind me, opens up my suit, and pours this water down me. She said, "How'd you feel about that?" I said, "Well, it worked, but the bad news is we're in Kentucky, we're married," but that's a different story. So I had to wear this suit to survive. So Paul says, if you're going to be a spiritual creature, and you're going to survive in a physical world, you need a weapon, no? You need righteousness and salvation and truth and faith and peace and the Word of God. He used the imagery of the warrior costume because he didn't have the snorkel suit. It's not about going to war. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and rulers of darkness in the heavenly place. Paul says, look, your enemy's not people. And don't get this imagery that when you go out here to speak the truth, that you're out there with your shield pushing people around and hacking people. The LGBTQ movement is not your enemy. The humanistic psychologists are not your enemy. The evolutionists are not your enemy. The transgender crowd are not your enemy. They are victims of your enemy. And when your enemy can get you to hate them, he gets them and you. they're already victims of the war. And if we go shoving them around and hacking them up, they just believe more, folks. Do you understand? I'm not talking about compromising our morals. I'm not talking about calling wrong right. But I'm saying that if the devil gets us not to speak the truth in love, and he can get us to get out here and declare war and fight, and he gets it and gets us to. Because the fingerprint of discipleship is love. But speaking the truth in love, we grow up in all things into Him who is the head, Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together by what every joint supplies according to the effective working by which every part does its share, causes the growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. When I do a survey and figure out what I'm good at, whether you're a ball coach or a computer engineer or a farmer, and you take that ability, that knack God has given you, and you use it to make money, but then you use it to serve other folks. And if the only time you give to God is when they pass the plate, I give a percentage of my time. I see a certain percentage of clients for free. I donate a certain amount of ropes courses. I don't have a set speaking fee ever for church events. Now, the corporate world has to write me a check. But we try to give our time, our money, and our energy, because those are the things God has blessed us with. And when you use your talents as equipment to serve other people, and it doesn't have to be because you're an elder or a deacon, and nobody's taking anything away from how important those factors are, but all of us can't be elders and deacons. And all of us can't be preachers. And everybody who does preach it, okay? But you take what you do as you are going about. You use your talents and you use your abilities to serve. Service is love. That's a fingerprint of discipleship. Then the church grows. We have unity of faith, unity of knowledge. We reach the measure of the stature of Christ. We're false doctrine proof. And when we have to deal with the doctrines of the devil, we do the speak the truth in love. And then we grow. And we grow because we're connected to Christ. And please understand that connection to Christ dictates our behavior. Our behavior doesn't connect us to Christ. Make sure we get that. Our connection to Christ dictates our behavior. Our behavior doesn't connect us to Christ. In 2 Samuel 3 or 4, 1 Samuel 3 or 4, when the Philistines captured the Ark of the Covenant, are the Philistines now children of God? Okay, what's the Ark of the Covenant? It's the Ark that represents the... whoever named it, it's a genius. Okay, it's the Ark that connects to the covenant. Well, the children of Israel have it, now they don't, so the Philistines are now the children of God, right? Well, that's ridiculous. The children of Israel weren't connected to God because they had an Ark. They had an Ark because they were connected to God. Your attendance in this building doesn't connect you to God. Your connection to God calls you to come to this building and worship and pray and give and sing and listen and preach. My morals out here don't connect me to God. I know a lot of people who don't walk in a church building who are sexually pure. Because I'm connected to God, I have to be sexually pure. I can't walk as a Gentile walk. And if we never understand that our connection to Christ dictates our behavior, we've missed church growth, we've missed discipleship, we've missed evangelism. We grow up into all things into Him who is the head, that is Christ. Now listen to our relationship with Christ, from whom the whole body, joined and knit together, unity. I'm connected to you, you're connected to me, and we're connected to Christ. And our relationship with each other is determined by our mutual connection to Christ. You get over into the marriage chapter, he'll say, submitting to one another out of your reverence for Christ. Because of my connection to Christ, that's why I treat my wife like I do. That's why she treats me like she does. That's why we treat our masters that way. That's why we treat our slaves that way. That's why parents treat children that way. That's why children obey their parents. Because we're connected to Christ. So when we have this connection to Christ, the whole body joined and knit together by what every joint supplies. If you're not serving, you're not supplying what your joint is supposed to supply to the building of the body in love. According to the effective working. Now, effective working is a different deal. There's deficient and there's effective. And sometimes it's not the first time I ever shot a machine gun. I'm probably the only guy in the country who left Vacation Bible School to go shoot machine guns. We used to shoot the old Beretta PM12Ss, and I think we sold some Thompson subguns that we had in evidence. We still got two of those. But they got rid of these old 45 caliber Tommy guns and got the whole team H&K MP5s. Mark Clemens called me and said, Lonnie, the new machine guns came into town. A machine gun shoots rifle bullets. A submachine gun shoots pistol bullets. These are technically submachine guns. It's an H&K MP5. That little black gun that Stevens always carries. So I leave Vacation Bible School and go to the range. There's three clicks on this thing. One is S, that's safety. E is ain't, for one in German, I think. And R is rapide, or rock and roll if you're American. Okay? So it's my turn to shoot this thing. Well, guess what I clicked it to? Well, yeah. 800 rounds a minute, 10 bullets a second. And if you stick that thing on your shoulder like you're shooting a deer rifle, it'll go. And you can shoot those 30 rounds faster than I can drop my keys to the floor and not hit a thing. It was very efficient, but it was not effective. There's a sign on the range at NASA. It's got a target and bullet holes beside it. And it says, you can't miss fast enough to catch up. If you'll take that little sling and put it around your shoulder, called a single point singleton sling, shorten it and then wedge that gun center mass on your chest so that where your eyes look, that barrel looks, if you'll step forward and do a crunch, and pull that trigger and not fight it and just let it rock, you'll draw a circle you can put a softball through with all 30 rounds. Then it becomes efficient and effective. Which every part does its share by the effective working. Fellas, you got to ask, what are we doing and why are we doing it? If it's not accomplishing a purpose, if it's not being effective, stop doing it. Don't hire a guy for your fall gospel meeting and have him come in here and preach the steps of salvation and fundamental church doctrine if you're not going to have any visitors in the building. Don't have Vacation Bible School where it becomes a daycare service for uninterested people. Why are we doing what we're doing if we're not doing it for a purpose? And if it's not accomplishing that purpose, change your modality. Brad Montague said that when McDonald's invented the drive-through window, they did not change the Big Mac. They changed how it was delivered. Not asking to change the gospel, but ask, are we being effective in our delivery of the message of the gospel? And why are we trying to preach salvation to the saved? Well, if you're going to have a fundamental gospel basics meeting, fill your building up with people who don't know the basics or don't do it. Every part does its share by the effective working. When every part does its share, causes the growth of the body for the edifying of itself in love. By this shall all men know you're my disciples if you have what? When we're known for love, and it's not that we talk about it, but that we display it in how we live our lives and what we do in our communities, the body grows. And that's evangelism. It's a fingerprint of discipleship. Because disciples make disciples. And you can't make disciples without service, without humility, and without love. And your work is different than, it's not But I've got to evangelize the whole world. I just got to evangelize my world. And when I evangelize my world, and you evangelize your world, you evangelize, those circles eventually overlap. And I believe that's probably a different perspective on evangelism. That it's not necessarily about sitting down and having a Bible study. It's doing something in somebody's life so that when you sit down to have a Bible study, you have influence. And look at the cases of influence in the Bible. Look at the worlds that were changed by slaves. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, prisoners of war, saw themselves as God's servants, and King Nebuchadnezzar called them servants of the Most High God. You've got a little girl who's taken from her family and put in the harem of Ahasuerus. And she changes the fate of the Jewish nation. Not because she's some great harem girl, she's a little Jewish girl. What do you think she knows sexually that the king of Persia doesn't know? It wasn't her sexual prowess that got her to be queen. It was her poise and her inner beauty and her demeanor. Naaman, the Assyrian captain, had leprosy. There's a little girl at his house that they captured in a raid and brought her home to be their house, their domestic help. You ever tried to get a teenage girl that you've raised to do the housework? This is a prisoner of war that's been captured in its work. My teenage daughter would have said, "He got leprosy? Good, I hope his head falls off." This little girl who's a prisoner of war and is the house slave says, "You know, if you knew my God, you wouldn't have leprosy." And on her recommendation, a captain in the army goes to a different country. And when the prophet of that country makes him mad and he storms off, his servant says, "Hey, you know, if he'd asked you to kill a dragon, would you do that?" "Yeah, well, then why not go dip in the water?" The people of influence, not power, but influence, have been your servants. And the Son of God came not to be served, but to serve. And if my master is a servant, the greatest thing I can ever hope to become is a servant. The effective working by which every part does its share causes the growth of the body for the edifying, the building up of itself in love. And there's the fingerprint of discipleship. Thank you very much for your time and your attention today, gentlemen. I'll turn it